From the University of California, Irvine, this is UCI Minds Spotlight on Care, the podcast where we share stories, experiences, tips, and advice on caring for loved ones affected by Alzheimer's and other dementias.
Welcome to Spotlight on Care. I'm Virginia Nave, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Steve O'Leary. Today, we have a very special show, as we are welcoming Dr. Nathaniel Chin from the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Chin is an esteemed geriatrician and wears many hats at that university. He is quite busy as an associate director of the Geriatric Memory Program, medical director of the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, or the RAP study, the director and clinical core co-leader of their ADRC, and is an associate professor of the Department of Medicine Geriatric Division. If that weren't enough, he is the host of a very popular podcast called Dementia Matters. Welcome, Dr. Chin. We're glad you're here.
Thank you for having me, and I think it's exciting to be able to do this and then to have the two of you on Dementia Matters.
So that you're on the other side of the mic.
I will be on the other side. And just so you know, I am the medical director of the Alzheimer's Center.
Wow.
The director role would be nice, but that would be my boss.
I don't think I'm there yet. Okay.
So, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I must say that I love your podcast, and it's a pleasure to listen to.
Thank you.
I would say our podcast, Spotlight on Care, focuses a little more on caregiving tips and dilemmas for caregivers. And your podcast seems to focus a little more on the side of science and research. Would you agree about that? And tell us about that.
I would agree. And I think we speak to what we're most comfortable with and what we know. And so as a physician in a memory clinic and a researcher, I think the scientific aspect comes naturally to me. And then based on my listening of your podcast, it makes sense to me that you guys speak to this very important topic of caregiving and the experience of caregivers who are certainly involved in the process. And both are intertwined, and that's why we need multiple voices in this process, and I appreciate you adding that voice.
Very well said. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Tell us briefly your personal experience with Alzheimer's disease. How did you get into all this with your career path and your life?
Yeah, it was quite jarring, as I'm sure it is for people, families who have a loved one with Alzheimer's. I didn't know that much about it, even though I'd gone through medical school and was an internal medicine resident when it happened. I got called home during my second year of residency, which is sort of training before you become a full-fledged physician. So I was in San Diego at the time, and my mom brought my sister and I home, and she shared with us that she was worried that my father had Alzheimer's disease. And he was young, so he was 61 at the time. And he was our main family physician in our small farm town in Wisconsin. And so she had this family meeting, and she really had us sort of face this fear of what we were seeing. He eventually got evaluated and was diagnosed with mild stage dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. He stopped practice that day. And from there, I lived the next 2 years thinking about, well, what am I going to do with my life? And so I thought I was going to do infectious disease. I trained in undergraduate to microbiology, so that was my whole plan, and I didn't do that. And I did hospital medicine for 2 years as I was sort of thinking about what am I going to do with my life, both professionally and personally. And then time came that my wife said we really need to go home, and fortunately she's from the same town.
Oh, really?
And so we moved back so that we could be, I call it secondary caregivers to my mom, who's the primary caregiver. So we were there to support her and to help my father. And then that really kept me in Wisconsin. And then I did my geriatric training, my dementia training, and here I am.
He really did have early onset, didn't he?
So that's what's interesting. So we use the term early onset when we think about it. Traditionally, it's age-based. So someone who's younger than the age of 65, we call a younger onset. But pathologically, or the science of it, is there is a gene that predisposes someone that if they have this gene, they're going to develop Alzheimer's disease. But you can actually be younger and develop Alzheimer's disease without having that gene. And so the age is, it's an indicator, but it actually isn't the end-all be-all. And there's no one else in his family that had it. And fortunately, he was a brain donor. And so he gave his brain to our research program. And actually, I was there for the brain cutting and to view those slides with the neuropathologist. And he ended up having advanced Lewy body disease as well. So it was two diseases.
Oh, so it was as well.
Yeah, so it was Alzheimer's and Lewy body. So he declined quickly and developed it earlier because he had two things, probably more, but at least two things.
How many years did he live with
that? He lived for 5.5 years with that, yeah.
That is kind of quick.
It is quick, yeah.
So you mentioned being a secondary caregiver, and when we chatted, that caught my fancy because I think there's a lot of people that are in this helping the primary caregiver. Talk about what you did and why your mom reacted positively to the whole experience of having you there.
Well, interestingly, I would say my mom probably demanded that presence. And she's a very strong German lady. And she doesn't mince words. And so I think it was her expectation that my sister and I both were on the West Coast at that time. And she wanted one of us to come home and support my father and, in essence, support her. She didn't frame it that way. But what is so important is that it's exhausting to be a caregiver. I mean, I don't have to tell you two that. And frankly, caregivers often don't ask for help. And so I think indirectly she was asking for help. So it was my job to address the things that she just was too tired to address or just didn't have the knowledge to. And so as a medical person, I was able to really help take care of all the medical issues and to think about the medical part of it while she was doing the day-to-day caregiving. And then frankly, it was spending time with my father so that she could go and see her friends or go to her own health visits. And then it was really just spending time together as a family because that's what he really wanted. And so then, of course, as his disease progressed, then I was doing more hands-on things to help him. He had bed sore at the end.
And was he at home?
Yeah, he lived and died at home.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I called a secondary caregiver. I mean, there are times where I felt like a primary caregiver in the moment, but it was really there to support her. And he really wanted my mom to be the person who was caring for him. And then I think Steve and I talked about this before. My wife was a tertiary caregiver because she took care of me because it's such an emotional roller coaster. And so there's just so many layers of care. And I learned from that, one, caregivers have to be involved in the conversation. So in my clinic, families are expected to come. I want them to come. I talk to them just like I talk to a patient. And then two, I know that they're going through a lot. So we have to talk about those things because the health of the caregiver can drive the health of a patient, since they're so intertwined.
Let's talk about that for a second, because I think you were in an opportune position to talk about the challenges that you saw with your mom. And from a medical perspective, that I think, you know, as a caregivers, we think we're so strong and we can handle anything. And the reality is we need support, you know, and we need as many people as we can that are going to be there. So what was it like supporting your mother? How did she accept or not accept your assistance?
Well, like you said, there are times where she would accept it and be thankful, and there are times where she said, absolutely not. You are the child. You don't get to make that decision. And I respect that relationship. But I would say there were times where so my mom was a beekeeper because we lived out in the small, you know, out in the countryside. And there was an incident where my mom, the bees got into her beekeeping suit and she got stung a lot. And I was fortunately there, and we had to drive her to our local emergency room, and it was very traumatic. She was fine; she got epinephrine just in case, and I had to say to her, "That's it, get rid of those bees. It's not you becoming ill is going to be devastating to Dad, and we have to protect you." Even though it was something she was really passionate about and cared about, but she understood in that ER that that was a very traumatic experience. And so sometimes I had to force these conversations. Other times it was more, he would come to visit me in Madison. They lived about an hour away. And so he and I would spend time together while she would go and run errands and go to her own medical visit. And that was really gratifying, twofold. I got to spend time with my dad, but then I also knew I was helping her by offloading some of the things that she
was she handling the finances of the family?
She was doing everything. Everything. I mean, I was helping with medications and some of the medical questions, but no, she was doing, it was a full-time job, as both of you know. It requires everything of you. And certainly as the disease changes, you become tired because your sleep is impacted, you're exhausted from the physical nature of caregiving. And so I would help in that way. I would go and get groceries for her. I would go and do some of these things that to me seem very simple, but I think were more meaningful because it just at least offloaded some of her responsibility.
Sounds like you were a pretty good secondary caregiver.
I tried to be.
I would say.
Let's talk about how this experience influenced your choice of the career.
Well, so as I said, I really have been passionate about infectious disease. I really like viruses. I just find the microbiology interesting. And then all my mentors were infectious disease doctors. And of course, that would have come in handy during the pandemic. I probably could have done some interesting things. But I wouldn't say that it hit me to my core. It was more intellectually stimulating. But it didn't feel as personal as I thought a job could be. And so after this experience with my father, and this was still happening. So as I was researching and as I was thinking about this, we move home and I figure I'm moving home. I'm leaving this beautiful place that I didn't think I'd ever leave. And I want to make something of this experience, this opportunity, if you could say that. And so I met with the head of the geriatric group in Wisconsin, who was actually my attending when I was a med student. So years earlier, I had met him. And I told him, I want to do something with Alzheimer's. I don't know exactly what that would look like, but I want to be involved in this. I have skin in the game. I care about this. Unfortunately, this is where timing and the right place. In Wisconsin, at the time, we were the only Alzheimer's research center that was based in geriatrics. And as an internal medicine doctor, adult medicine, it's usually neurology, and I'm not going to go back and do 4 more years of education to do neurology. And so I was able to do a 2-year fellowship, advanced fellowship, then doing geriatrics and memory care. And so I was he facilitated this process so that I could do exactly what I wanted, which was be in the room with people like my father and my mother so that I could evaluate and care for people who are experiencing these changes.
How did your mother handle the diagnosis?
She knew it was coming. So I would say before the diagnosis, that was probably harder as she was concerned and noticing changes in my father and not knowing exactly what was happening, but she did a lot of research for months leading up to that family meeting with us, where she, at that point, figured it was going to be Alzheimer's disease. And so I think that was probably the harder part. What was a barrier is that my father was doing well in all regards, minus having these lapses. So really, was there something wrong? Was it just stress? All of the reasons that people think about. And even the primary care doctor, his primary care doctor thought everything was fine too, and he scored perfect on all of these thinking tests. And so everyone said, no, there's nothing, it's probably stress or sleep more.
That is so typical.
Right? And so, but she pushed and said, no, this is not right. I know him better than all of you.
And you said your sister had a pretty good clue as to what was going on. She called you and she actually mentioned either Alzheimer's or dementia when she would tell you that she was concerned about your father.
So my sister, I think she was actually caught off guard the way I was until the family meeting. She was quicker to say, no, I agree with mom, something seems wrong. I think I was the one who was most in denial at that point. And so she started seeing changes after that meeting that made her feel like, nope, this is, mom's right, this is likely Alzheimer's or just some form of thinking change. Whereas it took longer for me to come around to that. And so, but after my mom, in essence, forced this evaluation, that's when he eventually got the diagnosis, but there were barriers put up. And I recognize those barriers, and actually it's one of the reasons I care so much about this idea of early detection, early evaluation, because no one was to blame. The system was not set up in a way to allow for people with memory concerns to be detected sooner. Our instruments are dull. Our questionnaires aren't appropriate. We don't put enough stock into the family with concerns. And there's just not time. 15 minutes is not enough time to talk about memory. And so now in my position, I'm investing more of my energy into how can we make this process better. But it was through that personal experience.
Well, that's a great segue because we want to talk a little bit about your perspective of dealing now on the other side of the bench, if you will, with other caregivers and other people with forms of dementia. What do you say to people who are either in your podcast about the issue of early detection? And what do you recommend as the first step that people should take when they think something's amiss?
So what usually the first one that have concerns is the family, a spouse or a child. And I will say to them, it's best to record what you're seeing. Not as a way of showing it to the person saying, look, you've made these mistakes, but so that you can keep track of the things you're noticing, because you will question yourself. You will question whether or not you're right or not. And so having these things written down allows for you to say, no, I did observe this. There are these mistakes or these issues, these symptoms, so that when the time comes to have a family meeting, and ultimately everyone has a family meeting of some kind, you feel prepared for that. And it feels funny because you feel like, oh, I'm hiding something from my loved one, because I'm not encouraging people to confront at that point. But it allows for you to have space to write down the things you're seeing and worrying about, and then potentially researching yourself. And then when you're ready, you meet to have a team so that you can talk to the person you're worried about. And ideally, that leads to an evaluation. You go in to see your primary care provider, and then you start a process. Many things are reversible. Our minds inherently jump to Alzheimer's disease, but it could be depression, it could be medications, it could be sleep apnea, it could be your thyroid. And it is our job on the medical side to look for those things first, because they are present. And so if we can treat those things, then people might actually feel better. If it's not present, and it really is a brain disease, well, the earlier we get to that, the more we can do, the more we can talk about it. You can get into research. Of course, that's my bias with my other part of my job, but you can get into clinical trials. We could start other medications sooner, but ultimately we can talk about this more, break down the fears, and move forward feeling confident that there is something we can do.
You mentioned a big word that we've heard over and over again, and when you work one-on-one with other caregivers, you hear this word, fear. It's like the C word was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I've got cancer. Or in this case, I'm afraid to even get tested because I might find out.
Right.
Or evaluated. So how do you help the person understand that this is nothing to be afraid of? Because the ultimate, how do you deal with this issue of fear?
I acknowledge it and I embrace it, because I think it's completely understandable to be afraid. Many people fear dementia more than they fear death. And nothing's really going to take that away. But what I can talk about is the quality of life of a person living with dementia, which can still be quite good. I can talk about ways that we can slow symptoms of decline. I can talk about ways that we can reframe what's happening so that you can still enjoy the time you have. We're all going to die at some point, and we don't know what's going to cause it. We don't know when. With a diagnosis of dementia, that puts a little bit more time or a little bit more perspective on that timeline. And maybe that forces you to do the things that you've been putting off. I will have conversations with my patients and families. You've wanted to go to Italy for the past 5 years. Now is the time to go. Go and live.
What a good idea.
And so we use that, and not in a good way, meaning like no one wants to be diagnosed with dementia, but it can force a person to embrace the fact that we are all going to die at some point. You are at your best right now. Things will get harder in the next years. You should do these things now. You haven't talked to your child in X number of years. Now is the time to reconnect, if that's important to you, which I would imagine it would be. So we use that to push people. I call it lovingly push people to do the things they've probably wanted to do and would have done maybe 30 years later.
You know, I've never thought about that. But that's true, because it's not going to get better and better through the years. It's going to get a lot worse. Do these things now.
Right.
So it sounds like you're actually becoming a consultant, like a life consultant here, in an interesting fashion, where you're dealing obviously with the disease or the perception of this disease, but you're also advising them about their stage of life and where they should go and how they should do things. Isn't that a little different than most docs?
Yes, geriatricians, we have training in palliative care. We are not palliative care experts, but palliative care is this wonderful field about, let's align your health conditions with your goals, your values. Let's talk about the future. Geriatricians are experts in aging and getting older, so we combine these two perspectives. And then certainly, I'm not speaking on behalf of all geriatricians. I come into the clinic visit differently because I've lived this. You know, I was the secondary caregiver, so I know what it's like to be in that third chair in my clinic room, and I know what the other two people are experiencing because I've talked to them. And so I jokingly will tell my colleagues, both geriatricians and neurologists, I have a street credit that not everyone has. I will say things to families that I don't think other providers are comfortable saying. They might agree with, but it's not comfortable to say it because I've lived it. And my patients tend to know my background. I think a lot of patients look up their doctors ahead of time, which is good. And so they know my experience. I don't hide from that. I actually explain that to people. And I think that allows me the space to tell people that I think things that matter, these life coach things that are not medical, they're based on experience. And I think that actually is more impactful than, oh, I have this drug for you. I think letting people know what things will look like down the road and things we can do that are not medical or medicine-based are actually probably more meaningful to the family.
Well, you've touched on this word, geriatrician. Why don't we go there for a little bit? I think I mentioned when we chatted, I understood it was a term. I didn't really understand what the role was. I didn't, and I'd like you to speak about palliative care again. But why is a geriatrician approaching things from a different perspective than a neurologist?
Well, neurologists are true experts in the brain, like a neuropsychologist who's a PhD and does a lot of cognitive testing. Neurologists are physicians, though they have a medical degree, and they understand so much about neurons and the cells that help neurons and the diseases of the brain as well as the nervous system. So they do 4 or 5 years of their own education after medical school, all brain-related. I mean, primarily stroke, primarily movement disorders. And then some of them will do an additional 2 or 3 years in what's called cognitive and behavioral neurology. Those are true experts in Alzheimer's and dementia. It's extra training that not everyone has to do. And many of them will become researchers. So I get to, I have the privilege of being able to work with some of them. And so it's a different perspective because they're very brain focused. I don't think they would disagree with me saying that. Geriatricians, on the other hand, we have training in adult med. Well, I guess you can do it from family medicine, which is kids to adults, or internal medicine, which is what I did, which is adults only, 18 and older. And you then do more training in people 65 and older. Because to think that a 70-year-old is the same as a 20-year-old is just foolish. And so after we've done 3 years of internal medicine training, we do an additional 1 to 2 years in 65 and older. So we have more experience in aging, in frailty, in having multiple comorbid or health conditions, being on multiple medications. And then we are really quite trained in nursing home care, in hospital confusion types of care, and then memory care, falls. So there are certain things that we just tend, they're called geriatric syndromes, that we tend to focus more on. But ultimately, we focus holistically. I know that's a common phrase, but we really do look at beyond the biology of a person to their social issues, to their mental health issues. We try to combine everything. And as a result, we look at Alzheimer's differently. A geriatrician looks at Alzheimer's as merely a piece of the things happening to people. And so we involve our team right away. So a social worker, a nurse, neuropsychologist, physical therapist, occupational therapist, we don't try to do it alone. So inherent to our training is this idea of a team. And that's relatively new.
Yeah, that's a different approach than a neurologist's approach. At least that's my experience. You're talking about time in a sense that I my experience with it and my conversation with others is every time a visit happened, it was brief with a neurologist, sometimes not. I mean, mine, Patty's was terrific, but in fact, we were always waiting. We were always a half an hour to 45 minutes late. But we weren't, but that's what happened. But and it was fabulous. I guess my question is that the industry is so driven by efficiency, and you're now as a caregiver, and you're looking at how to get the best care. Would you recommend that geriatricians are going to be spending more time versus a neurologist, or would you recommend where should you start in this game, or this journey, I should say, when you've got concerns?
The reason that's a tough question is so much of it is regional dependent and then institution dependent, because each healthcare system is going to approach it differently. You ultimately start with primary care, and they have less time than anyone. But once you have a diagnosis, then you could go to a specialist like a neurologist, but they might not have as much care or much time either. But there are these things called collaborative care models or memory clinics. And that usually is, and that can be neurology-led, psychiatry-led, or geriatric-led. And that is a team-based approach. This is not unique to Wisconsin. Many great programs involve a team. Those are usually longer visits. And so you inherently, in a memory clinic, there's more time built into it. And then I would say geriatrics inherently does have more time. I have an hour with my patients, which sounds crazy. But I have an hour, and I do bill for a full hour or more based on the time leading up to that visit. And so...
But you're covered for that hour.
I'm covered for that hour. There's no other expectation other than I'm talking to a patient and their family.
Nice.
Yeah. And that I don't know how common that is. I will say geriatricians usually have more time than any other field. But interestingly, right, geriatrics does not make money. We think of ourselves as money-saving for healthcare institutions because we see the most complicated patients and we help them along their journey, but we're not generating revenue the way a surgeon generates revenue.
So my conclusion after a long time now is that there's nothing wrong with starting your relationship with a geriatrician and adding neurologists rather than the other way around, and that this combination of both is powerful. And you need, if you've seriously got, like, I loved your example where your mother pushed for this evaluation, because sometimes the internist is like, well, everything's fine. Patty had the five questions and that was it. I was like, I don't know, no. But I didn't, I accepted his opinion. So that's very helpful, I think, for our audience.
I'm curious, are they starting to train hospital personnel a little bit more thoroughly on dementia? When my mom had dementia between 2005 and 2013, our hospital visits were just awful. It seemed to me that no one surrounding her knew what Alzheimer's was. It was frustrating to me. She would rip out her tubes and such. And it's like they would call someone in, but they weren't terribly kind with her. They didn't really understand where her mind was. Are they starting to train people a little bit better on this?
More and more providers of all kinds are understanding what dementia is. Delirium, which is acute confusion that often happens in the hospital, more and more hospital physicians, nurses assistants are learning more about this and being prepared for it and the proper approaches for it. Dr. Sharon Inouye from the East Coast, at Harvard, she's really led this huge effort into educating delirium, which is primarily hospital-based, although it occurs at home too. And so there's more and more education. Now, that happens to be primarily for physicians and nurses, but more and more students in healthcare are learning about dementia.
Good.
As well as delirium, and both are important. And so, so ultimately the goal is people don't have to have that experience or prevent people from going into the hospital when at all possible.
Yes.
And so, yes, more and more education is happening at all levels of healthcare.
Can we go back to this evaluation for a second? Because you've obviously performed many evaluations. What's involved in it, briefly, and from your perspective, of the things as a caregiver that you ought to expect from a valued or quality evaluation?
Yeah, and I'll go briefly for you, Steve, because usually this is like an hour-long talk that I do in for different physicians. So from the caregiver perspective, what they should prepare for is that they are needed at the visit. They should not have the loved one go alone, because what we really want is history. History is the most important thing. So we want to know what the person is experiencing, and then we want the family member to tell us what they are observing.
Again, let me interrupt you. Again, we're back to this point about keeping a record.
Well, that's helpful. Yeah. I mean, it makes it easier. But we want to know, when did it start? What were the initial symptoms? What has it been like over the past X months or years, depending on how long you wait? And then we're going to look at reversible factors. What about your thyroid, your depression, or sleep apnea if they're present? What about things that we can treat? And then ultimately, there will be some form of cognitive testing or thinking test. And that's a separate conversation too, because there's many debates as to what's appropriate. You talked about 5 questions. That's not enough, right? We need to do more thorough testing. And so, but some form of thinking, objective thinking test. And then from there, it's blood work, a head image, and then probably true, legitimate, thorough testing. And I mean 1 to 3 hours of testing. And then an expert, like a neurologist or a geriatrician, coming and talking, putting it all together for you. You're not going to get a diagnosis at one visit. So for a caregiver, it takes time. And I know that people want answers right away. So it's good to get started early, but it's going to take multiple visits to figure this out.
Well, that presents a problem, because the caregiver might be more interested in it and, of course, making the time available. But we're running into this fear factor again. Well, I'll go once, but I'm not going a second or a third time for more evaluation. So how do you deal with that? How do you set the stage for that with the patient?
And we see this a lot. And so that's why the first visit's so important and building the rapport is so important. Oftentimes at the first visit, we will do some form of thinking test just so that we can get it. And because if they don't come back, at least we have some objective score.
When you say some form, a MoCA, what do you?
Yeah, I mean, this is where I think there's a lot of debates. I like the MoCA. I think it's a better test for mild cognitive impairment in general, and I tend to see people coming in sooner. I don't think a lot of these tests, these 3-question tests, they can tell you maybe more advanced dementia versus not, but that's not as helpful because people are coming in sooner. So I tend to favor the MoCA. I don't have an arrangement with MoCA, so I don't have any sort of obligation to them. But I will say, when possible, I explain to people reversible factors, modifiable factors, and that there are things we can do even if you do have a brain disease like Alzheimer's. So my buy-in with the patient is that if you're willing to stick with me for at least a few visits, I will focus on your quality of life and your well-being, even if the end result is this is Alzheimer's and I don't have a cure for you. I will work on your sleep. I will work on your physical activity, your mental activity. I'll try to reduce your medication load. I will try to get you to be as functional as possible. I will make sure that your wishes are aligned with what your family is hearing.
So you're building trust.
I'm building that relationship, and it's more than just the brain disease. So I'm trying to help them holistically, and I do get buy-in from that because we all want that.
Well, let's go on to talk about clinical trials. I think we want to touch on that since that's a big part of what you do, and I don't want to make sure we have enough time.
Yes, we want to discuss, I know you're really involved with clinical trials, but I wanted to just mention in here that your last podcast number, 178, oh my gosh, that was so good, a guest, Cindy Sierra from Texas, was talking about, let's see, you've titled it, From Caregiver to Research Participant Partner. And her mother did not want anything to do with being in a clinical trial. By golly, nothing. She ended up in one. And it's been a very positive experience. Your podcast was great. I just thought I'd plug number 178 on Dementia Matters. I want to talk about clinical trials.
Well, I did want to say that, you know, so I worked with Sarah Walter up at
USC.
Yeah, USC, and she's a part of the Clinical Trial Network. And, you know, she's so connected to participants, as we are and as UCI is. And it's such an important voice, the participant, the study partner, or whatever term we use for the family that comes with them or the friends that come with them. And what we're trying to do is put a voice. So we call the series Voices of Participants. We want listeners to know that the experience of the research participant and their family matters. It influences the type of research we do, how we conduct research, whether or not people are going to come back and do longitudinal research, whether they're willing to give us their blood, their brain. And so all of these things matter. And so we need to know what is impactful for them. So this was a four-part series. We have three more individuals coming out over the course of this year. It was really exciting. And I tell you, it was so meaningful to be able to talk to these participants. There's a lot of emotion in these conversations.
Sure.
And we wanted to capture that because this isn't, not everyone enjoys every aspect of research. And that's okay. But we want to know what is meaningful and what we can do better. And so thank you for mentioning that. That was it's a different type of podcast. But what you guys do, this idea of the caregiver, this idea of the person on the other side of the table, well, they matter a great deal.
There's something about the way you talk that's amazing.
Well, thank you.
You have this calmness and this positive attitude about what you're doing, and it's evident.
I totally agree. We need more of you. We can clone you everywhere.
Thank you. I don't want clones of me, though.
Well, let's talk about your registry a little bit. Talk about RAP.
Yes, RAP, the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. Actually, the doctor, that geriatrician who started RAP, Mark Sager, was the doctor that diagnosed my father. And so he started this in 2001. Geriatrician, scientist, but more, I would say more of a geriatrician and a great one at that. And he started this group. And he said, you know, we need to know about people at risk for Alzheimer's. We got to go sooner than the patients that we're seeing in clinic. And so he formed this registry of pretty much children of those who were affected. And you had to be a certain age. And I mean, we had to have certain inclusion criteria, but we wanted to study them over time. And you will not find a more loyal, dedicated group of participants than RAP participants. And I know I'm at UCI, and they're great participants here too, but you will not find more dedicated people than RAP participants. And so we've had, we've been going on since 2001. The average duration of a RAP participant's 12 years. They've come in six or more times to do lumbar punctures, PET scans, physical exams. They're there for about 6 hours, 4 hours of thinking tests. And so we have a lot of data. So it's a great study. At some point, I don't have the year for you, this brilliant researcher named Sterling Johnson took over. This is when Dr. Sager retired, and he brought a new edge, a new viewpoint to RAP. And he's a neuropsychologist, so it's cognition-driven. So we are trying to understand what impacts thinking ability, which, of course, is what we care about. You know, as a person, I'm not sure we care about the changes in our brain. We certainly care about symptoms. And so he's very focused on that as well as the changes in the brain. And so now we are very focused on cognition and biomarkers, this idea of a blood test or a PET scan that reflects what's happening in the brain. And so we have over 1,000 PET scans that are amyloid-based, 700 PET scans that are tau-based. And I'm not sure if there are other programs or single studies that have more than us. And I'm not trying to be competitive. I'm just trying to reflect what our participants are willing to give. And then the investment that Dr. Johnson and the whole RAP team have given to study this. And so we're able to make some pretty impressive conclusions and involve researchers from all over the world who can have access to all of this data.
You share that information.
Yep. They have to apply for it, but as long as it's a scientifically valid question, we share that data. With permission of our participants, of course, they have to say it's okay.
You and I spoke about this thing called new drug therapies and the pros and cons of that. Want to talk about that as we conclude here?
Yeah. So because of our ability to detect Alzheimer's disease in living people and in people who have not yet had symptoms, we call preclinical, that opened this opportunity for drug intervention. the whole course from preclinical to having symptoms. And the main therapies right now that everyone talks about, although it's only a segment of it, it's called monoclonal antibody therapy, MABs. And they are an infusion base. So we think of them like chemotherapy. You hang a bag and it goes into your vein for about an hour. And they're very effective at getting into the brain, stimulating a response, breaking down this first protein of Alzheimer's called amyloid and removing it. And we've shown this now. The scientific community has shown this through three drugs, and each drug gets better at doing it. One of them is FDA approved, called lecanemab. So that is being used both in research and in clinics now. And it's hugely debated as far as not its ability to remove amyloid, but is it effective for the person? Which I'm glad we're debating that, because that ultimately is the most important thing. There is a roughly 30% slowing of decline in over 18 months when people are on this drug. I'm very careful about how I phrase that, right? So 30% slowing. You are still declining with this therapy, but it's slower. And so people will ask, is that meaningful? And so that's what's being debated. There are side effects like brain bleeds and swelling. And so that, those are things, and it's a huge impact on the healthcare system. So these are things that people have to consider, but it's approved. Medicare covers a good percentage of it. And so there are clinics across the country starting it. What Steve and I talked about earlier was that, while exciting, and I'm very excited about the beginning of what I think is a new era, there are impacts not only to the person receiving it, the patient, but also the family. You are, in essence, prolonging a period of caregiving too, right? So you are changing how the caregiving experience is. We don't know the impact of these drugs on behavioral and mood symptoms. They're studying this, which is good, but that changes the caregiving family perspective. So there are things we have to understand. This is relatively new, and the studies are short. And so we have to know 10 years later, what does this look like? So it doesn't change the important things that we've talked about and the caregiving that's involved. None of that's different, or none of that becomes less important. It becomes more important, arguably, because the person is experiencing thinking change for longer.
Yes. And when you said that, I clicked into the two reactions I would have. One, the reaction of the person with the disease thinking, well, wait a minute, do I really want to live longer? And secondly, the reaction is the caregiver, which in my case would have been, I'll take all the time I can get. And of course, where is it in this process? And what's the reaction of both parties? And how do you talk your way through all of that? I mean, on the surface, it's like, hey, great. But really?
Yeah. No, I think it comes down a lot of times to quality of life. I looked at my poor dear mother the last 2-3 years, and I felt so sorry for her. Was she happy? No, not really.
And that both of you, right, have different responses to that mm-hmm. question, right? You want longevity. You don't. Longevity is not your number one priority.
That is true.
Right? And so everyone's going to view this differently. But that's important to know and be able to talk about, because not everyone's going to say, this is meaningful enough, I want to continue. And not everyone's going to say, you know what, I'm comfortable letting this person go. These are hard conversations.
Sorry. Yeah. But Patty actually asked me twice to help her die.
My mom did too.
And so that's why I'm saying, even in my mind, it would be a debate. Here she is saying, I don't want to have to live this way. And where does this drug come into that process? So it was like a whole, like, a light went off in my head that I hadn't thought about. So I wanted to make sure we covered that. Yeah. Well, we're slightly over time, which is great, because you've been fabulous, absolutely fabulous.
Thank you so much for coming here today, all the way from Wisconsin. We got you out here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Nate, I just have to say that we need more people like you, at least in my perspective. I'm not dealing with the medical community like you are, but you ought to find ways to go out and talk about your perspective, and especially talking to people who are considering a career in medicine. We all know what's coming. And we need more people like you. We need more geriatricians. We need more people that have this kind of commitment and involvement. Amen. You need to do that.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Spotlight on Care is produced by the University of California, Irvine, Institute on Memory Impairments and Neurological Disorders, UCI Mind. Interviews focus on personal caregiving journeys and may not represent the views of UCI Mind. Individuals concerned about cognitive disorders, prevention, or treatment should seek expert diagnosis and care. Please subscribe to the Spotlight on Care podcast wherever you listen. For more information, visit mind.uci.edu.